Perek Lamed Hey, Chumash Bereishis, Old Testament, Chapter 35, Pasuk Aleph, 186. Basically, the times before we finished the story of Shechem, where Shimon and Levi destroyed the entire city of Shechem, Yaakov was very angry at them, and he said, "What are you doing? They're going to be chasing me." And they said, "We cannot make our sister free for all." So starting now, Perek Lamed Hey. Yaakov Avinu, meanwhile, is in the city of Shechem on the way home, returning to his father Yitzchok. Vayemer Elokim El Yaakov, Hashem says to Yaakov, "Kum, get up, Alei Beis Kel, go up to Beis Kel." And the reason why Hashem is telling him to go to Beis Kel, whichever way you pronounce it, is because Yaakov Avinu, 22 years earlier, made a vow that when he comes back and Hashem brings him back home, he's going to make a sacrifice on the same place where he made it on the way going. And now it's 22 years later, and he's preparing the final return home, Teretz Yisrael. So Hashem said to him that you now, because you made the vow to go to Beis El to bring a carbon, so go bring it, make your Mizbeach, and don't have any delays. The Shev Shaman dwell there. Vasei Shem Mizbeach, you should make a Mizbeach. Lakela Nira Elecha, to the God who appeared to you, Bavarachacha, when you were running away, Mepnei Esav Achiv, because of Esav, your brother. Now, what does it mean, remain there, stay there? So, the Ramban writes, basically, he didn't know exactly what does it mean, live there, because he wasn't supposed to live there. He's really supposed to go back to Yitzchok Avinu. It says they should become, some of our Shemlin, what it means, dwell there, not in a physical sense of staying there a long time, but rather become imbued with the holiness of the altar of the Mizbeach and the Karban and the sacrifice that you're bringing. Now, number one, the question over here is, why does it say go up to Beis El? Okay? So the simple answer is because geographically, Beis El is higher than Shechem. This is the way that Barbana learns. That physically, Beis El is higher than Shechem, so he's telling him to go up. It doesn't only mean in the physical sense, but it also means in a spiritual sense. Yaakov Avinu is going closer to home, and he's going to be bringing a sacrifice. So he's telling him, Alei, he should go up in a spiritual sense of elevation compared to the level that happened in the city of Shechem. In the city of Shechem, his daughter Dina became impurified, like when they raped her. And therefore, he's telling him to go up and, you know, go up in a spiritual way.
How can it be pronounced Kel when it's Aleph?
Huh?
You might want to pronounce it Beis El, Beis El?
Yeah, because Beis El means literally the house of God. So some people don't like to pronounce it Beis El, so they say Beis Kel. But either, when you're learning it, really doesn't matter. Okay, another interpretation of a Shev Shom is that you should wait there until I give you further instructions. So wait there until God says, and wait there until I tell you where to go. Another thing that Rechaim HaKadosh says, what does it mean live there? Yaakov Avinu was hesitant to stay in Beis El because the Canaanites were there, and they were a very corrupt nation. And Yaakov Avinu was afraid of a replay of Shechem. So therefore, Hashem said, don't worry, you could stay there, nothing's going to happen to you. But I say, Shem Mizbeach, you should make there a Mizbeach. And Ramban says, what does it mean, make there a Mizbeach? Prepare yourself spiritually for the Mizbeach. We've learned in the past, the whole concept of sacrifices, which is called Korban, is really from the expression of Karov, of closeness. The reason why a sacrifice is called Korban is because it brings a person closer to Hashem. That's the concept of a Korban. Many times when a person brings a carbon, the concept of a carbon, especially if it's a sin offering, is the concept that really the person should be sacrificing himself. Right? If you sin, you really should be burning yourself on the altar. But God in His generosity says, you know what, bring an animal instead and I'll consider it as if you bring yourself. Therefore, in the olden times, when people did bring a sacrifice to the Beis HaMikdash, they had to. It was actually a spiritual preparation. It wasn't only you take an animal, just okay, schlep it to the Beis HaMikdash and slaughter it. It had to be like the Ramban says over here. You have to make the preparations, make an altar. Just can't just bring a carbon. You have to prepare yourself for it. Okay, and you should bring it. Lokela nira ilacha. The pasuk concludes to the God that appeared to you, and this carbon therefore will be a thanksgiving carbon, which in the Beis Hamikdash there was a concept of a thanksgiving carbon. Nowadays we bench gomel when we have an aliyah, you know, to thank God. Or we say every day in davening Mizma L'Saida, right after Baruch Sha'amar, we say Mizma L'Saida, which is the prayer of thanksgiving to God. In the times when a person, in the time of the Beis Hamikdash, they had an obligation to bring a carbon. So this was basically a carbon that Hashem saved him from Lavan's house, from fighting the angel of Esav, that he came out alive from Shechem. All these cases demanded a carbon. So, Pasuk Beis says, V'yemei Yaakov al Beisei, Yaakov said to his household, obviously it doesn't mean to his house, it means to the household, V'alkol asher imei, and to all those people that were with him, meaning all those that accompanied him, the servants, or the maidservants, the workers, whoever was there. And he said, Hasiru es elokei ha-nechar, you should remove the foreign gods, asher b'seichecha moshin yirim mitzt. In other words, as the Mefarshim explain, where did they get idols from? When they killed the city of Shechem, and they took all the spoils from the city of Shechem, so the people in Shechem were idol worshippers. So the Jews ended up with a lot of idols. And Yaakov is telling his people, get rid of it. You're going back to Israel, we're going to bring a carbon to Hashem, get rid of all these idols. Even though it said the Jews weren't intending and worshipping them, but nevertheless, the fact that the non-Jews worshipped them, the law was they had a din of Avodah Zarah. They had a din of idol worshipping. And the din is, you have to get rid of it.
Why did they take it to begin
with? Huh?
Why did they take the idols to begin with?
Because the Jews, don't forget, the Torah wasn't given yet. The Jews maintain that if it's an idol that I'm not worshipping, I just want to wear it for a decorative necklace or earrings or, you know, whatever it was, that would be allowed. And Yaakov Avinu said to them, no, you have to remove it. In fact, there's an interesting klayakot over here. If you look in the pasuk, it says, "Asidus alakei anechad asher b'seichachem which in your midst." The klayakot asks, he should have said, "Remove the idols asher b'yatchem." B'yatchem means in your possession. B'seichachem means in your midst. He should have said, "Remove the idols that you own, not the idols that are in your midst." So the klayakot says, he elaborates on this concept a lot. Yaakov Avinu is telling the Jews, remove the idol from within you. Not only the physical idol, but remove the idol asher besochechem, which is in your midst. That's an interesting concept. Here he calls them Elokei HaNechor. Kei HaNechor is not Avodah Zarah, simply means foreign gods. So the commentators discuss this concept. You have in the Aseret HaDibros, it says, don't have for yourself any foreign gods. And Rashi comments in Chumash, an interesting point. The truth is, there's only one God. You can't even say other gods. What are you calling them gods? God forbid to call an idol a god. So Rashi says, Elokim Acherim doesn't mean other gods. Rashi in Chumash says, Elokim Acheda means that others call them gods. They're not gods. Elokim Acheda means that others, Achedim, make them Elokim. Other gods. Other people make them gods, but they themselves are not gods. The same thing, Elokei HaNechor, some Mefarshim learn that it means that the foreigners make them gods. Because God is not even going to call. In fact, the Gemara tells a story. An emperor, asked one of the rabbis of the Gemara, is your God such a jealous God? He says, God is jealous of other gods. I mean, what's wrong with him? He shouldn't be such a jealous God. He keeps warning us not to have foreign gods. So the rabbi answered him with an analogy. He said, can you imagine that if a guy was married, and he left his wife for somebody more beautiful than she is. than his wife is. So the wife is upset, but at least she can understand why. What happens if the husband leaves his wife for somebody uglier and more foolish and less person, and nothing, he can't compare it to the first wife? Then the wife gets angry. Whatever chutzpah, he leaves me for her. So the same thing it says, compared to Hashem, all these idols are nothing. So God says, the Jews are leaving me for stones and pieces of gold. I mean, what, is he crazy? That's why God is a very generous God.
Rabbi, quickly.
Yeah.
Before the Jews were ordered to get rid of spiritually and physically these idols,
mm-hmm.
Today most of the Jews there have an idea that those idols were worth something to them financially or brought them riches?
Yeah, but it didn't matter. That doesn't matter. Now, there's a deeper interpretation over here of the word Elokei Nechad. Nechad, in fact, this is an interesting concept in Torah. Idols are called Avoda Zara. That's a word for idols, Avoda Zara. What does the word Zara mean? Zara in Hebrew means foreign. Foreign. Avoda Zara, Chassidus explains, any Avoda worship which is foreign to a Jew is called Avoda Zara. Even if it's not idols. Anything which is foreign to the Jew, anything foreign to a Jew is called idol worshiping. That's the terminology. Avedas, in Hebrew you have Avedas Alilim, that's the worship of idols. Avedas Zara means foreign Avedas. Anything which is foreign to a Jew is called Avedas Zara. Let's leave it. Have to speak good about Jews. No, it's not true. By the way, let me just finish the point, then I'll explain. Elokei ha-nechad, nechad is foreign. That's what the word nechad means. Foreign. Yaakov Avinu is telling the Jews, you have foreign gods within you. Besochachem, like we said, not in your hands, but in your midst. What does it mean, remove the foreign gods? Anything that a Jew worships is called a god. What does it mean, worshipping? Worshipping means you put it above and beyond yourself. And worshipping idols is basically if you put anything above and beyond God. In other words, really a Jew should worship Elohim, God. If a Jew has Elokei HaNechad, if a Jew worships something foreign, so that becomes idol worshipping. And many times that's within the Jew. Now, for instance, if a Jew is doing business for the sake of being able to make a living, to live properly like a Jew, when a Jew does business, and a Jew does business in order, and even though if he doesn't, ideally a Jew should constantly think about it, okay? But even if they don't, but generally the purpose of business is to be able to make a living, to be able to live like a Jew, that's called worshiping God. If a Jew eats in order to be able to be healthy and live like a Jew, that's called serving God. That's not idol worshiping. When a Jew takes business or eating above and beyond the call of living, but they start getting so involved in the business that business controls them rather than God or Judaism or Yiddishkeit or Torah, so then that becomes foreign gods. Then the business becomes foreign gods because you're putting the business above and beyond God. In other words, if a Jew is doing business to be able to live like a Jew, then there's no way that business could contradict acting like a Jew in business. Right? If a Jew knows that the purpose of business is to serve God, then how could business cause him to do things against God? Like, for instance, even to cheat in business or to do all these things in business. If a person's doing business as a tool to serve God, so how can you cheat in business? Or how could business allow you not to keep Shabbos? Or you know what I mean? All these types of things. Then it becomes a lekei anecha. Understand? To give crazy examples, I mean, because they're not so crazy. If a person puts sleep over God, then they're worshipping sleep. If a person puts money before God, you know, then that's called worshipping gold, the golden calf. As people say, the golden calf is the concept of worshipping gold rather than Hashem. Anytime a person will put anything above and beyond God, I'll give you a simple example, okay? As everybody knows, you don't have to be very smart to know that there's a World Series playoffs going on, I mean, pre-World Series playoffs going on. And many times, let's say, the game is at the time when a Jew should be in Shul davening Mincha and Ma'ariv. Okay? And he has a choice. Should he watch the game or should he go to Shul? Abel, I'm not talking about you. Now, the question is, what should... Okay, the Jew has a choice. Should I watch the playoffs, especially the Yankees and the Mariners? It's a big game tonight.
It's all over, 9-0 Yankees.
Okay, thank you. So, okay. But at least you came to Mincha Ma'ariv.
That's okay. Great.
Okay, anyway. Let's not get carried away. So, if somebody puts... Hello? If somebody puts the game over Shul, that means they worship the game. That is called Elokei Anecha. Now, is the game idol worship? Are you bowing down to an idol? No. But is that a foreign god? Yes. Instead, so there is, it depends how a person acts. You can have, that doesn't mean you can't play a game. That doesn't mean you can't watch a game. The question is, are you worshipping the game? That's the question. Are you worshipping the game? That this takes up your primary time, energy, existence, soul.
How many people do you know that do that? I mean, when the guy is right down to the business, he's not thinking that. He's thinking directly the money.
Right. But I'm saying, but if, yes, there was a chassid of the Alter Rebbe, Rabbi Yamin Kotzker, there was a lumber merchant, that we said the story many times, and you know, they didn't have calculators in those days. They used their brains, not like today. Today you don't need brains, you just need to know how to punch buttons. In the olden times, they had brains. So he had a list of numbers for his business, and then he draws the line, you know, to make the sum total, and he writes, Sacha Kol, what's the sum total? And he wasn't thinking. And he made all the 30 numbers, and he figured it out, and he wrote, Sacha Kol, Ein Eid Mulvadei. There's nothing but God. The sum total of his business, and he didn't do it for a show. When he was thinking, he lost himself for a second. What's the sum total of all his business? That there's only God. Understand? That is the way a Jew should be. So there is, as the Pasuk is saying here, Yaakov Avinu is telling to the Jews, there are Elokei Anecha Hashem B'Seichachem, there are foreign gods within the person, meaning foreign thoughts, foreign ideas, foreign concepts, foreign worships. Or, I'll give you another example that applies today also with considering worshipping foreign gods, even though it doesn't necessarily mean bowing down to an idol. What happens if you have a scientific theory, okay, that contradicts Torah viewpoint? Okay? So if a Jew, even for a moment, will entertain the idea that science is right and Torah is wrong, at that moment they're worshipping science over Torah. Okay? And as the Rebbe said, Torah is true. Any proven fact in science is true, not a theory. If it's a proven fact in science, it's true. Truth cannot contradict truth. Theories could contradict truth, but truth can never contradict truth. But I'm saying if somebody would put, let's say, scientific concepts above and beyond the Torah viewpoint, or, well, Torah says you can't do it, but I think you could. And don't tell me people don't think that way. People do think that way. So then, that's also worshipping their intellect over God's intellect of Torah. If a person wants to do something that the Torah says don't, Torah says don't eat something, a certain food, or don't say something, or don't think something. The person says, well, I really want it, and you go eat it. But at that time, you didn't bow down to an idol, but you worshipped your feelings, your temptations, instead of worshipping God. And this is what Yaakov Avinu is telling the Jews. Get rid of the foreign gods which are in your midst. And he says even more, V'hitahado, purify yourself, V'achlifu simleitzechem, and change your clothing. Because according to Torah, when the person becomes impure, then his clothing becomes impure. Like we find many times in Chumash, the Torah says you have to wash your clothing, means putting it in the mikveh to purify them. In the olden times, in the time of the Beis Hamikdash, if somebody was impure, then the clothing became impure, they would have to put the clothing into the mikveh too, besides the body.
It's not enough to wash it?
No, it means v'chipsu bigdechem is in a mikveh, the Gemara. Rashi also says in Chumash. They had to put it in the mikveh. They couldn't put it in a washing machine. It had to be purified.
You didn't have a washing
machine. No, homemade washing machine.
Basically, any time I would follow my temptations, I would wash it in the
night. Right.
Or any sin.
Anytime we do something anti-God, we're worshipping something else. I mean, it's quite simple. Bowing, idol worshipping doesn't, that's why Aveda Zara is called Zara, because it's foreign. Anything which is foreign to the Jew, to God, to Torah, is idol worshipping. That's the bottom line. I mean, it's nothing, you don't have to bow down to an idol on a wall to be bowing down to an idol.
But Avoda means what, right?
Worship. Okay, it says you have to be tired, purify yourself, and and change your clothing. Okay? Rashi says, what does it mean? Lest you'll have a garment of yours that will be in idol worshipping. There's a spiritual garment. In addition to the physical garments that the Pasuk is speaking about, there are also spiritual garments. Spiritual garments refers to thought, speech, and action. In Tanya, he elaborates, the soul is composed of 10 levels, intellect and emotions. In addition to that, the soul also has 3 garments. The garments of the soul, without elaborating in it now, are thought, speech, and action. The Jews are coming now, basically, from a Lavan environment, which was not very pure. Then they came into the Shechem environment, which was far from pure. So Yaakov Avinu, coming back to Eretz Yisrael, is telling the people, get rid of everything foreign. Get rid of all the foreign things. Then purify yourself and purify your garments. So there's 2 things. In order to purify oneself, changing your garments, you first have to clean yourself. If you were in the mud and you got dirty, changing your clothes alone is not going to help you. First, you have to remove the dirt from your body, and then you can change your clothing. If you're going to put on the new clothing on dirty body, you're not going to do anything. So the Torah says you have to purify yourself, meaning your intellect and your emotions, and then he says you have to change your garments. Instead of thoughts of deceit and trickery and idol worshipping that existed in Lavan's house and in Shechem, you have to change your garments completely, from machshava, dibur, and maisa, thought, speech, and action of evil, to thought, speech, and action of good.
Which one comes first?
Huh?
Which one comes first?
When you want to go to a wedding and you change the clothing, first you wash yourself. First you change your intellect and emotions, and then you have to go change your garments, thought, speech, and action. If you're going to have intellect and feelings of evil, and you're going to start thinking and talking, what are you going to be thinking and talking? Evil. So what are you accomplishing by it? There's one more interesting lesson that this Pasuk teaches us. Yaakov said, at the beginning of the Pasuk, it says, Yaakov said to his household and to all those people that were with him. Okay? So they bring down from Sefer HaChassidim that teaches us, first reprove members of your own household and then reprove others. You want to change, first change your own household and change others. It's always easier to change everybody else. So the Pasuk says, first change yourselves, He spoke first to his household and then to everybody else. Okay, Pasuk Gimel, Venukuma Venale Basekel, or Basel, whichever. We're going to go up to Basekel. By the way, this is an interesting source of a halacha. There's an interesting halacha in Torah. It's called rabbinic conversion. But one of the sources for it is really this pasuk. If a Jew, God forbid, converts to a different religion, or a Jew started going to services in a church, or things like that, that they accepted a form of idol worshipping, and then they... So a Jew is always a Jew. I mean, even if you say you're a guy, you're still a Jew. A Jew, once a Jew, always a Jew. But the din is, the law is when a Jew comes back to Yiddishkeit, they have to go through a rabbinic conversion. What does it mean? They have to go to the mikveh again, and they have to accept mitzvahs. They have to accept the yoke of a mitzvah. Just like when a person converts, they have to go to the mikveh. Over there, they also need a bris if it's a man. They need a bris and a mikveh with the acceptance of mitzvahs. So here you need it rabbinically. A Jew that turned away from Yiddishkeit and accepted different religions, when they come back, have to do it. And the source of it is in this pasuk. The Jews accepted these idols, or at least they took them in their possession. So now the pasuk says you have to purify yourself after you get rid of the idols. So you have to actually change your idol, purify yourself in the mikveh, and accept the yoke of God. And you have to, we will get up and we go to Beisel. And Yaakov said, I will make there an altar, lokel to the God, who answered me on the day of my dilemma, or when I was running away from Esav, or in Lavan's house, wherever it may be. And this Hashem was with me, in the way that where I went. Okay? Wherever I went, Hashem was with me. So what did the people do? Vayitnu al Yaakov, they gave, believe it or not, everybody listened. Even though it was gold and it was worth a lot of financial wealth, so to speak, without any hesitation, Vayitnu al Yaakov, they gave to Yaakov as kol alakei anecha shebiyadim, all the foreign gods that they had in their hands, v'asa nizamim, and the rings, Asheba's name, which were in their ears, Vayitman esam Yaakov, and Yaakov buried them, Tacha Sa'ola, under the terebinth, the type of a tree, Asher in Shechem, which is next to Shechem. Okay? Now, there's an interesting question in Halacha. If you have idols, Halacha says you have to destroy them. You have to pulverize them. You have to chop them down and throw them into the ocean and destroy them completely. The question is, why did Yaakov Avinu only bury them? If according to Halacha, Yaakov kept Torah, so why didn't he actually pulverize them and destroy them completely? So it says a number of things. Number one, it says Yaakov's son did not take away the idols until the Shechemites renounced it. And once a non-Jew renounces the idol that he did, it doesn't have the law of an idol anymore. If a non-Jew renounces his idol, so that idol doesn't have a law of an idol, so therefore it wasn't necessary for Yaakov to pulverize it. Another reason it says, Hashem told him, go quickly and make a mizbeach and bring the sacrifice, so he didn't want to waste any more time. Another thing it says, Rabbi Nebuchadnezzar says, Yaakov Avinu was afraid that the people are going to chase him, because they killed the city of Shechem. Right? So he was afraid people were going to chase them. So he wanted to do it as quickly as possible, that he should be able to move on rather than spending all the time destroying the idols.
Somebody can find it and worship it
again. They're not going to find it.
Well, you have to accept it as an idol for it to become an idol.
Yeah.
So if you just buy a statue, an antique statue, and you put it in your house, it's not an
idol. It depends if somebody had it beforehand and used it as an idol, or if it was made explicitly for an idol as a din of an idol.
Rabbi, what's a terebinth?
Huh?
What's a terebinth?
I don't know. It's a type of a tree.
Say again?
It's a type of a tree.
Rabbi,
yeah.
If you find a gold cross, you're not allowed to pick it up?
It depends. Gold cross. If you're talking, no. A cross is only an idol piece if it was bowed down to. People wear a cross on a necklace. is not, nobody worships it. It's jewelry. We're talking about idol worshipping is when they actually worshipped it. If there was a cross that people bowed to and things like that, then... Yeah, but it's a piece of jewelry. For instance, a very interesting halacha question. Can a Jewish jeweler sell crosses? Or can a Jewish engraver, if a non-Jew buys a cross as a present for somebody, to bring to a Jewish engraver to engrave a message, are they allowed to do it? The answer, if it's jewelry piece, is yes. Because it's not idol, it's a piece of jewelry.
Are they allowed to wear it?
A Jew? No, they shouldn't.
It's not an idol.
Yeah, but, you know, come on. It doesn't look too Jewish.
Well, we're on the subject of
idols.
Someone bows down to an idol. Okay. It's not measured the same way that someone would, let's say, see if his contention is smoking or watching a game or something. It's not the same thing, is it?
The truth is, it's the same. Except, that's pretty powerful, huh?
What's the question?
The question is, if we said before, any foreign thing for a Jew is really idol worshipping, he says, if somebody worships football, is that as bad as bowing down to an idol? That was the question. The answer is, it is the same. The difference is, a Gemara that Chassidus elaborates on in many, many places. The Gemara says, Amar Reish Lakish said, famous Reish Lakish said, Ein Adam Eiver Aveira, Elim Kein Nichnas Beiruach Shtus. The only reason why a person transgresses a sin is because a foolish spirit enters his mind, which would be, in today's court language, be temporary insanity. Which, by the way, in our court system, you can get away with murder, literally murder, with temporary insanity. Now, in Torah says, every sin a person does is a ruach shtus. Shtus is retardation, insanity, is because of an insane spirit coming into the person's mind. And that allows the person to sin. A foolish spirit. We have enough hard time with Jews. Let's deal with the Jews. Let's when we finish with the Jews, we'll go to the other guys. Now, what's the ruach shtus? A foolish spirit. What do you mean the person is foolish? A person thinks that if I, let's say, eat something I shouldn't be doing, that I shouldn't be eating, or thinking something I shouldn't be thinking, or saying something I shouldn't be saying, or doing something I shouldn't be doing, the Jew thinks, well, listen, I'm still a Jew. Right? I'm still a Jew. Okay, so I sinned a little bit, but I'm still connected. When it comes to bowing down to an idol, a Jew can't make that mistake that says, I'm still connected if you're accepting who knows what. Right? If you're accepting an idol, you can't even think in your mind that I'm still connected to God. The truth is, Chassidus explains, every sin, no matter what the sin is idol worshipping. No matter what the sin is idol worshipping. Why? Idol worshipping, in any definition, means you deny the existence of God. That's what idol worshipping is, right? You accept another God. You deny God and you accept another God. If, by definition, a person believes in God, by definition it means that God's presence is omnipresent. He's all over the place. That's the definition of a God. You can't have a God someplace he is, someplace he isn't. Then he's not a God. Because God is true. If he exists, then he exists all over. Right? You can't have a God that exists only in Europe and not in America, or only in New York and not in LA. I mean, you know, you can't have it. God exists all over. If a Jew believes, by definition, in God, that God is existing, and right in front of my face, God is standing over my, right in front of me, and God is telling me, through Torah, don't think it, don't say it, and don't do it. God is standing right in front of me. Okay? Like Rabbi Yechim and Zakkai, the Rebbe quotes the famous Gemara, that Rabbi Yechim and Zakkai in his deathbed, when his student said, you know, tell us something before you die, he said, you should fear God at least as much as you fear a person. And they said to him, that's it? I mean, isn't God greater? You know. These single guys always like to get rid of the machitza. So,
a shot.
So, playing both sides. Playing both sides, yeah. It's better to stand outside and look in than stay in and look out. That's for sure.
You know what the
liquor
to worship, don't you?
Okay, one minute. I'm going to forget what I'm saying now. So the truth is, God's standing right in front of our face, okay, and he says, don't do it. And I have the chutzpah in front of God's face to do it. Doesn't matter what it is, right? That is basically an open denial of God's existence. That is, in reality, an open denial of God's existence. God says in front of me, don't do it. That doesn't mean think it, say it. Doesn't matter. Don't do it. Or God says, do it. And in front of God's face, I say, no, I'm not. That is an open rebellion against any king, that the king will kill you. Rabbi Yechim and Zakkai said to his students on his deathbed, you should fear God at least as much as you fear a person. If a cop is watching you, if a cop is standing there, you're not going to rob a bank, you're not going to go through a red light, you're not going to do anything you shouldn't do. And he said, at least pretend God is a person standing in front of you, and you're not going to do anything wrong. What's the ruach shtus? What's the foolish spirit? The foolish spirit is, it convinces the person, come on, it's not the real stuff. It's not bowing down to an idol. You're not denying God's existence completely. But the Gemara says, that's insanity. It's shtus, foolishness. Why is it foolish? Because the truth is, any aveda that you do, or any mitzvah you don't do, is denying the existence of God. So the truth is, anything you worship is really idol worshiping. So why don't you get capital punishment for every sin? If a person eats or says or does or whatever, what they're not allowed to. So every sin is aveda zara. Because God is generous. And he says there's a temporary insanity clause that you don't realize it's idol worshipping. So you'll get whipped. You'll get this punishment, that punishment. God in his kindness is pushing God's generosity and kindness that he says, you're right. The truth is anything you do, lightning should come down from heaven instantaneously and kill you. Because you deny my existence. I don't worship you. God is kind. He says, listen, temporary insanity. You know, I'll let you get away with death. But you're going to get punished. Because you deny my existence.
You're all a bunch of idol
worshipers.
With all due respect to the
other. This is the room for tshuva.
Right.
You're not making that comparison to a football game.
If a person worships a football game over God, it's idol worshiping. Oh, Nebuch, no.
Is that deriving power from it?
They are cheering for
it. You know how much energy they're getting from it?
But they see God everywhere, even in the football.
Let me ask you a very simple question. If somebody is willing to pay $500 for a seat to a World Series game, but they won't pay $300 for a pair of tefillin, is that not idol worshipping? What is it? Where are the priorities? Worshipping idols means you put, worship means you put something above you. Right? If a person is willing to spend $500 minimum, or maybe even more, for a game in a sports arena, yet they won't spend $300, $400, for a pair of tefillin or for an esrig or for whatever it is, that's I don't want to speak. We're not speaking against Jews over here because we're all in the same boat. You know what I mean? But the point is, it's still a form of idol worship.
At the same time, if somebody asks me to worship idols, I'd rather die. I can do that. But if I go cheer for a football team,
why is it? Because that's the ruach shtus. That's what I'm saying. Again, I want to make it clear. I'm not saying you can't listen to football games, and that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the worshipping it. Instead, there's a big difference between enjoying a game or worshipping again. You know what I mean? There's a big difference. There's a big difference. There are people that worship food. That's all they live for. Or cigarettes. Okay. Next pasuk is a very interesting pasuk. By Esau they traveled. By he chitas. What do you want? What? What are you idol worshipping about? By Esau they traveled. By he chitas alakim. It was the fear of God. Alahaharim asher tzivirseyam, and the cities which are around them. When they didn't run, after the children of Yaakov. Yaakov Avinu was afraid, after they destroyed the city of Shechem, Yaakov was afraid that the people are going to chase him. And, you know, they're going to be outnumbered. There were a few people compared to all the nations. So Yaakov was afraid, but it says clearly in the pasuk that they traveled, and Hashem caused the fear, okay, of to all the nations of the world. All the nations, and they didn't chase after Yaakov. Now we know in the Chabad language there's something called chitas. Chitas is Chumash Tilim and Tanya. And this is the biblical, so to speak, source of the concept of every day learning a parsha of Chumash and every day saying the Shir Tehillim, the way it's divided into the monthly thing, and the second tough is Tanya, the way Tanya is divided in the yearly schedule. And it says that the Rebbe spoke, when he spoke about chitas, it said when a person learns chitas, it causes that the fear of God should be on all the enemies of the Jews, that they shouldn't be chasing the Jew. According to the Medrash says that the Goyim did gather together to chase the Jews, and all of a sudden they became full of terror and they all ran away. But there was a time that they actually were about to do it.
How do you get chitas out of this?
Chumash Tilim and
Tanya. But in here it says?
What? Chitas. It's an acronym.
No, but you don't drive it from here.
Where do you get it from there?
Chumash Tilim and Tanya. Why not? That's what it is, no?
But what does it mean?
The fear of God. The fear of God or the terror of God and all the cities that were around them, they didn't chase the... In other words, when a person learns these types of things in Torah, it causes a fear of the Yetzer Hara also. Don't forget, Goyim, and not only the external outside Goyim, is the internal Goy also. The Goy Asher Bekirbacha, which is the Yetzer Hara. And the Yetzer Hara also becomes afraid of all these things. And they didn't chase after the Jews. Okay? And the Ran says, that doesn't say they didn't hate the Jews. They still hated the Jews, they just didn't chase them. Okay, Vayava Yaakov Luza. Yaakov came to the city of Luz, Asher Beretz Canaan, which was in the land of Canaan, which is Beisel, Hova Chol Ha'am Asher Imei, him and the entire nation which was with him. They all came together. And therefore the Radak says, what does it mean over here? V'chol Ha'am Asher Imei. From all these problems that Yaakov had, not one Jew was missing. It says v'chol ha'am. It doesn't say v'ha'am, the nation which was with him. V'chol ha'am means every single Jew, every single member of Yaakov's team, or Yaakov's family, or workers, or whatever, were there. That actually nobody died. Nobody was missing. Nobody died in Shechem. Nobody died along the way. Nothing. But even Shem Mizbeach, he built there a Mizbeach to Hashem. V'yikra lamokim. And he called the place Kel Beis Kel, meaning the God who is in Beis El. Kisham Niglu Eilav Elikim, because that was the initial place that God appeared to him in Yaakov's dream, 22 years earlier, Bevarachai, when he was running away, Mipnei Achiv, because of his brother. In other words, what was the thank you that Hashem revealed himself to him 22 years earlier, and he brought him back peacefully? That nobody was missing. Huh?
In the same place.
Right.
That's the same place he slept with his father.
Yeah. And that was the city of Luz. But Thomas Dveira Menekes Rivka, Dreira, the wet nurse of Rivka, who's the nurse, in the old days, that wet nurse, meaning the nurse that fed the babies, died. But Tikoven, she was buried, mitachas lebeis kel, under beis kel, meaning under the city, which was on a higher place, at the foot of the city, tachas ho'alun, under the plateau, vayikra shmei, and he called the name of the place, Alun Bochus. Alun Bochus simply means the plain of many cryings. The importance of the sentence was a very important lesson. First of all, Rashi comments that here Yaakov found out that Rivka also died, his mother. And that's why it was called Aloin Bochus, plural. The Medrash says that this is that Rivka also died. Rivka is not mentioned as the only one in Chumash of the matriarchs that it says that she doesn't mention that she died. Even Leah, that the Torah doesn't say clearly that she died, but Yaakov Avinu later in Chumash says, I buried Leah there, in the Maaseh Machpelah. At least there's a mention in Chumash of Leah's death. Sarah, we have Chayi Sarah, Vatama Sarah, Rachel, we learned before, we're going to learn later that Rachel died. It says clearly she died. Rivka, the Torah is only hinting to that she died. Why is the Torah not mentioning clearly that Rivka died? So it says a whole bunch of different opinions. But the basic opinion is that when Rivka died, Yitzchak was old and not able to see. Yaakov wasn't home. The only one attending the funeral from the family would have to be Esav. Esav was a most hated person in the world at that time. Everybody hated him. He was a robber. Huh? I mean, he wasn't a good guy. If Esav came to the funeral, everybody would be cursing Rivka for having such a kid. She was the only one of the matriarchs of Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah that had a wicked son. Yishmael came from Hagar, not from Sarah. Rachel had kids, Leah had all the Shvatim, they were all tzaddikim. The only one that had a son that happened to be a Rasha was Rivka, who had Esav. So therefore the Torah is not mentioning her death. How old was Rivka though when she died? So now there's an interesting argument in Halacha. In a Medrash it says, Rivka was 133 years old when she died. If Rivka was 133 years old when she died, according to the calculations, she had to be married at 14. The accepted opinion of Rashi and many others is Rivka was 3 years old when she married Yitzchak. Remember, she was born by the Akedah. Yitzchak was 37. And then Rivka, 3 years later, Yitzchak, when he was 40, he married Rivka. So Rashi maintains that Rivka got married at 3. According to Rashi, you just figure out the years of Yaakov's life, when they were born and how long. Today, you don't have to figure out, they have it figured out already. According to Rashi, Rivka died at 122. So Tosis, in the Gemara in Ksubas, asks a question in Rashi, how could Rashi say Rivka was 3 years old when she got married? Which means that she died at 122, when the Medrash says that Rivka died at 133 years old. And based on that, she got married at 14. So Tosis Taka argues in Rashi, and says she got married at 14. Those opinions that say Taka she got married at 3, say she died at 122. They argue on that Medrash that says that she died at 133. Okay, so that's the story with Rivka. Why is it important to know that Dvorah died? And it's a very questionable in the commentaries exactly how it went. When Rivka sent, when Yaakov stole the brachas from Esav, right? And Esav wanted to kill Yaakov. So Rivka says, I want you to go to my brother's house, and I will send for you when I want you to come back. So Rivka kept the promise. She sent Dvorah, her wet nurse, to bring Yaakov back. Why did she send Dvorah? For a very simple reason. Yaakov had a bunch of little kids. Who do you send to help him come back? The nurse. You send the help with the kids. The only question is, when was she sent? Was she sent now? Or was she sent a long time ago and Yaakov still didn't come back? What's the issue over here? Yaakov Avinu was punished for the fact that he was away from home for 22 years. He was punished. That's why Yosef was away from him for 22 years later on. The question is, if Rivka said, don't come back until I call you, and she didn't call him for 22 years, why should he be punished? Yeah. He did exactly what his mother wanted. Therefore, some of Farshim learned that no, Dvorah went back earlier. Rivka sent for him earlier. And when he didn't come back right away, he was punished for all the years that he was away. Because he didn't come back right away. If he would have come back right away, he wouldn't have been punished for those years. But the fact that he delayed even after she sent to get him, so he was punished for all the years put together.
What was his punishment?
That his son was away from him for 22 years.
Yosef.
And just like Yaakov had problems with his brother Esav, Yosef had problems with his brothers. It was a replica lifestyle.
I get it.
Here is a hint that
Deborah
died. And
how Yaakov finds here? How? He probably heard the facts. In internet, email.
At the same time the
Deborah Rivka's
died.
Nurse. Yeah.
He died at the same time?
Yeah. Well, it depends when Rivka came. Here, Rashi recites the Medrash, that in this verse we have a veiled hint to the death of Rivka, for as the sages taught, while Yaakov was there, he was informed that his mother had died. In Greek, alone means another, meaning his mother died also. Then the whole question over here is... Right.
Did Yaakov favor any one of his sons? Did he favor any one of his
Yosef.
Sons?
Yosef.
Yes, sir.
Oh, yeah?
He made him the multicolored coat.
Yeah. And Broadway made a play about it.
Well, I guess so. One minute. Another thing they bring down, why did God hide the death of Rivka? God didn't even want Esav to know about it. He didn't want Esav coming to the funeral. Because it wouldn't have been respectful. Okay. Start one more pasuk. Vayera Elokim El Yaakov, God appeared to Yaakov again. What? Right. In Greek, the word alein means another. How does Greek get to Torah?
Yeah.
There are many words in Torah that are Hebrew, but they had a base in other languages too. For instance, the most famous one of them all is the first word of the Ten Commandments, Anechi. Yeah. The truth is, in Hebrew, the word is Ani, not Anechi. Ani. The Medrash says Anechi is an Egyptian word. Obviously now it's Hebrew title word. But it had its origin in an Egyptian language. The Torah uses it to bring out a lesson. For instance, in the Ten Commandments, the Rebbe asks, from all the Ten Commandments is the basis of the whole Torah. From the top ten is the first two. From the first two is the first. The first word of the first one of the Ten Commandments should be Egyptian. So the Rebbe explains the whole purpose of Torah is even to permeate Egyptian. In other words, even the lowest levels of the world has to be permeated by Torah. There are many words in Chumash that Rashi brings down that obviously it's a Hebrew word, but you see the meaning of it clearer in another language also. So alone, they bring down here. Where is this? In Greek, alone means another. According to Lambochus, it's not another weeping that he cried a second time for his mother. But you have many words in Torah. It's really Lashon, it's Hebrew. But they have a similar meaning in another language, that a basis in another language that explains the word in a clearer fashion. Huh? What? I didn't say Rashi says it's Greek.
No.
Here Rashi says Alein Belashin Yevani means Avel Acher. Rashi says it. Rashi says it's Taken.